Hi, folks. This is CBD at the Cut Jib Newsletter podcast. Today we have a guest. We're going to call him Vox Clematis. He prefers to remain anonymous. I'll give you a little bit of background, though. He's currently an appellate attorney, criminal and civil, in both state and federal courts. He had a career as a prosecutor with the U.S. Department of Justice, Assistant United States Attorney. I think he did a stint in the Trump administration, too. We'll leave where he did it alone. He spent a long time as a military intelligence officer in the Army Reserves. So I think that's about as much detail as I'm going to give you. But without further ado, here is Vox Clematis.
Hello, CBD.
How are you doing, Vox?
Doing well, thanks. Happy to see you. In fact, I didn't get a chance to tell you before we went on air. It just so happens today's my birthday, so I'm trying not to feel old.
Well, you know, we're waiting for Sefton to join, but it's his birthday 5 days a week. So, you and he share a birthday. So, maybe toss back a few.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what I would like to get a little bit of information from you is maybe a general description of the many, many legal flaws in the various January 6th prosecutions. I know that you are at least peripherally involved in at least one of them. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about the general tone of what is going on in Washington.
Okay, well, I've had some exposure since I've consulted with a couple of trial lawyers. As you mentioned, I focus on appeals, bringing to the table my past experience as a trial lawyer and a prosecutor. Now I just basically try to advise and assist when I can. It's ideal when a trial lawyer brings me in before trial or before the appeal, and we can do a clean handoff and help each other out. But I also help out and looking at a couple of those cases, and then I've reviewed a couple that have already been convicted and sentenced that were looking for possible appeals. I've gotten a bit of a panoramic view of the landscape generally, and I just have to say it's just entirely, totally political overkill. They have taken a bludgeon to these people, and they are hell-bent for leather that they are going to just cram it down the throats of these guys, no matter how minor the trespass or how otherwise innocent or law-abiding these people are. They're really looking to make a widespread example of these January 6th defendants, and it's appalling. When I was in the field, so to speak, I'd been in a couple of different districts across the country, and there are certain general rules of thumb or guidelines of professionalism that career prosecutors will use. That it's a certain common sense rule of thumb, seat of the pants, knowing what's worth pursuing and what's not, who's truly culpable. That we had always suspected that the small enclave in the District of Columbia was not quite so experienced or attuned to, but it's really come out in spades in this case. Plus, you see that in Washington, you'd always had a certain tendency not to have the high proportion of career long-term prosecutors that you'd see across the country, but you have an awful lot of transient people looking to check their box, get their ticket stamped. And you have a lot of detailees, volunteers, short-termers who really don't have the experience, but are looking to get the label and pretend on the resume that they were a prosecutor once. So you get people from the Department of Transportation or Education or other federal agencies where they can convince their supervisor to let them go in a detail and be on loan. And the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. is quite happy to bring the extra bodies on and throw things at them. Now, that didn't mean so much in the past if they were just helping with the random gun case or a couple of drug or traffic cases or something like that. I mean, D.C. is basically just a city. But now, with the particular political cachet, if you will, of going after the Trump people and making a point of heightening the narrative of January 6th, an awful lot of true believers who were otherwise in the government and in other parts of the country. I've known a number of folks who were working in either the environmental law section or in other New England states or something like that, and were all volunteering to go do a tour and help out put these evil Trumpers away. And so that's a lot of what you're dealing with in terms of the population and the staffing of these cases. And we've seen some turnover in the course of these cases that will, of course, take a while because judges often have backlogs. They don't have exclusively January 6 cases. They have plenty of other cases they're trying. And things will drag on, and you'll see in some cases that the staffing will rotate through, people will be replaced. So it's really from a point of view of a career prosecutor across the country, it's quite an island, if you will, of political intensity with less professionalism. So that's just the overview I can give you first. If you want to go into specifics, we can talk about some of the awful law attacks that they're
Well,
bludgeoning these defendants with.
what I'm curious about is how, I mean, the from my perspective, obviously I'm not a lawyer, but from my perspective, it is so blatantly illegal what these people are doing. First of all, the idea of a speedy trial has been tossed out. There are people who've waited, two plus years in jail, for their trials, and that apparently is ignored by the DC courts. And then, of course, the idea of sentencing somebody, 5 or 10, 15 years for what is essentially trespass, is obviously insane. From my perspective, it seems as if that in addition to the obvious attacks on anybody who is a Trump supporter, there is an attitude that is oozing out of Congress that how dare these people challenge our superiority, challenging, the very building that we have made so dear to us over the last couple of generations. And I think that might be part of the reason why these insane sentences are coming down. Now, obviously, the number of fellow travelers in the Justice Department is, as you pointed out, is probably approaches 100% at this point. But it's from a typical American standpoint, these sentences are just insane. So to end my long-winded soliloquy, what can be done ultimately in the appellate from an appellate standpoint? Can these sentences be reduced? Can they be essentially canceled by appellate courts and obviously ultimately the Supreme Court?
Well, the short answer is yes. You raised two very good points, CBD, and I'll just refine the first one. You mentioned you characterize it as a speedy trial issue, and I would just slightly recharacterize that. It's not so much a speedy trial. I mean, people can go to trial if they just put their foot down and say, no, I won't agree to any extensions. The problem really, and I think what you were focusing on, is the people who are stuck in jail. There are people who are out on bond, and that's not so much a problem for speedy trial as long as you're out living at home and you're not in jail. Most people can put up with the delay, especially if they know that it's to the benefit of letting their lawyer go through all the voluminous evidence. There's so many thousands of video clips, and by the way, the government's been playing fast and loose with that, what they will and won't allow people to see and what they will and won't bother going through their own records to find to turn over to the defense as an obligation on their part. But basically, the real problem was that a lot of these people, first of all, they didn't have very good defense lawyers, I'm sorry to say, because a lot of them, well, most of them, came from out of town. They were not residents of the DC area, which, as you know, is a problem with jury selection. But folks who were exercising their own First Amendment right to petition the government for redress of grievances and coming to take part in a political rally and a protest. And because they're from out of town and they suddenly, however, sooner or later, find themselves indicted and under criminal charges, what do? They go to find the only lawyer they might know locally. And I've seen people from North Carolina or Texas or places like that where they traveled. And when they get the indictment and the charges, They just reach out to somebody they know or somebody who knows somebody to get a lawyer. And they often get lawyers who were not from the DC area, had to get admitted, what we call pro hac vice, temporarily permitted and licensed to appear in that court. And they're often not necessarily criminal defense lawyers. So they didn't really know what they were doing, and they weren't very good about getting the bonds and release rather than detention in jail. And even some of the public defenders that the J6 defendants might draw, many of them weren't from DC either. The DC public defender, federal public defender's office apparently is exceedingly small. And with this large number of defendants, they've drawn upon other districts to have people come and help. Now, some of them are very good. These are the most experienced federal defense lawyers you'll see in many parts of the country. But a number of them, I think, were fellow travelers and really weren't putting their heart into it. So an awful lot of people, as you say, got put away in jail pending trial, and then they're left the language because it's hard to get that reviewed once you are in jail. And the problem was that very few people actually had the competence and the gumption to fight immediately for their client to know how to get that bond. The only reason they should be able federally to put you as a defendant in jail pending trial is to show that either you are a risk of flight or you are a danger to the community. None of these people were a danger to the community unless you're so far gone as a rabid foam at the mouth anti-Trumper that you think that their mere existence is a threat to the polity. But
Well, I think that you
this,
got you hit that on the head right there.
yeah. So, and the risk of flight, well, sure, most of these people from out of state, but usually what they do is they have them report to a probation where they're at their home district and check in, and that's how they just sort of make sure that they behave while they're waiting for their case to go to trial. So there is that problem. There are far too many people languishing, and I don't know the details, but there were reports that the DC jail system itself, which again I think was not necessarily in DC, but they sometimes used to farm out to Northern Virginia and contract. I know this is to be the truth in a lot of the districts across the country. The U.S. Marshals who are responsible for detaining federal defendants often contract out to the local county jails. And they have certain standards about how you're supposed to be fed and maintained and treated. But depending on the county jail, they could try to be maximizing the profit from that federal contractor. Who knows how they'll be treating you. But in particular, with these J6 defendants, we have many horror stories about being put in solitary and mistreated. So yeah, that's where it's very good, very important to have a decent, confident, and experienced criminal defense attorney to fight from the start there, get out the gate to make sure you can stay out on bond during a trial. I'll notice. I'll mention.
I would ask you right now, what is the possibility of finding a conservative-minded attorney in the DC area who is competent? That is truly the belly of the beast. If you
I
look
would
at the
tell you
look.
when you will see, when you will see, and she's very prominent on Twitter, and I think you'll enjoy this aspect, CBD. Her name is Marina Medvin. She's not only a very good criminal defense lawyer, and she's fighting tooth and nail for, I think she does almost all J6 defendants these days. But she's also an ardent supporter of Israel, and you'll see her frequently. You've met, she's probably already in your Twitter feed if you're on the X Twitter. And she views it, I know, as sort of an outlet from the tensions of the day as criminal defense lawyers, that she'll express herself conservatively and politically on Twitter and X. So I can mention and laud her specifically. She's one of the best criminal defense attorneys. She's in the DC, Northern Virginia area. So she's very good. And then there are others who've come to the fore. Another guy who you'll see on Substack and on X Twitter, he goes by Shipwrecked Crew is his handle. His real name is William Shipley. And like myself, he's a former career federal prosecutor. And the interesting thing about him is he's based in Hawaii, but he still has picked up a fairly large caseload of January 6 defendants. And from everything I can see, I have not met the fellow, but I read him and follow him from a distance. And I've not caught him doing anything wrong. I think he's on the ball and quite committed, and he's a darn good defense lawyer. So those are two people I can commend by name to folks if they want to follow them, read them, or even support them. So they're out there. It's just a matter of having them come to the fore and people know where to find them.
So,
I don't.
my obvious hope is that these cases will meander their way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will slap down these federal courts in Washington. But
Well, you know, there
obviously
is
the
one case now.
go ahead.
Are you aware of the one case that's pending right now in the
No.
Supreme Court?
Go ahead, tell us about
Okay.
it.
Yes, it's called United States versus Fisher, Fischer. It's very interesting from the point of view of an appellate attorney and criminal defense attorney, and it's got major implications for all of the January 6th defendants, as well as the prosecutions and litigation against Donald Trump. In a nutshell, there were three separate January 6th defendants, each of whom were present, and I believe even went into the Capitol building. I know Mr. Fisher did. There were three of them who all managed to have the luck of the draw to draw the one independent-minded, with a spine district judge in D.C., and that's Judge Carl Nichols. I forget who appointed him. I have a hunch he was a Republican appointee. I don't think he's a Trump appointee because I think he's been there longer than that. But you're going to hear this case will actually be argued before the Supreme Court on April 16th, I believe. So we can earmark that and let people know to watch out for that. And that's coming up. The statute in question, and this is one of the examples of the overreach and bludgeoning by the politicized DOJ. They have charged all of these defendants, and most everyone, with a felony count that's called Section 1512C. It's in Title 18, United States Code. And Title 18 is where most of the federal crimes are. This is a statute that, bottom line, was created. You and I know CBD. We can recall the Enron crisis at the turn of the century, 20 years ago, when there was a big accounting scandal and white collar corporate fraud in the Enron. I believe they were an energy corporation, but they were basically cooking the books. And it was a big collapse because all of the employees of Enron had their pensions and best invested in the company, and it was all big. Corrupt mess. Well, some of the then overzealous prosecutors, including charges against the Arthur Anderson, big accounting firm back in the day. And Arthur Anderson actually wound up going bankrupt as a result of that prosecution. They basically were charged with criminally concealing the fact of the fraud at Enron. They had been doing the audits. In the course of that scandal and that investigation, even though too late for Arthur Anderson, it went out bankrupt and had to dissolve. But the Supreme Court ultimately, in Arthur Anderson's case, ruled unanimously 9-0 that they had done nothing wrong. But that was too bad because the prosecutors had already basically killed that corporation. So there was the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation that came out of that, and folks may know that. And that added some more specific statutes to go after criminal accounting fraud and securities fraud. And specifically, that they accused the folks at Arthur Anderson of destroying certain documents that was evidence. Arthur Anderson said they were just following their normal document retention policy of getting rid of stuff when they thought they no longer needed it or needed to keep it. And the little loophole that was in the then existing law was said you could indict somebody and convict them if they had induced someone else to destroy a document that they shouldn't have. But there was a loophole of sorts in that there was no law specifically making it criminal to do it yourself as opposed to induce or tell somebody else to do it. So they passed this law that became what's now Section 1512 that talks about destroying, impeding, altering, changing, or otherwise making unavailable key documents that are documentary evidence in a criminal, white collar criminal case. So in 1512C, it says you can't do that. In part one, it lists specifically to not alter, amend, destroy. And then in part two, it says, or otherwise impede or obstruct the progress of a proceeding or investigation. Now, this is sort of a term of art in drafting laws, but basically you will list a number of things that are the target of your law that are criminal conduct you want to stop. And then just in case, the law drafter will say, or otherwise, or any other such thing, just to basically make sure nothing slips through the cracks. Well, that's what was at issue with these three January 6 defendants. The Department of Justice has wielded this white-collar criminal provision in the law, which, by the way, has a maximum penalty of 20 years imprisonment. It's a serious felony. And they're wielding it against these people who basically trespassed and caused a commotion with the mob on the grounds and in the building. Their theory is that, well, by being there and giving substance and body to the mob, you created such an obstruction that impeded the proceedings before the joint session of Congress to count the electoral votes. So this was all a horrendous and horrible, what's the word? Crime against the administration of justice, basically obstruction of justice crime. So they've taken something that was meant to go after people who shred accounting documents and corporate crimes and wielded it like a bludgeon against people who were basically misdemeanor trespassers. So Fisher was one of the three guys who were lucky enough to draw District Judge Carl Nichols, and they made a motion to dismiss that particular account to say, look, this really doesn't apply to what happened here. And Judge Nichols, in a very well-written opinion, took a look at it and said, you know what? You're right. When I analyzed the statute and it talks about altering, amending, destroying documents or records, or otherwise impedes or obstructs, I think this is all about evidence impairment and witness intimidation, all about going after people who might try to extort or influence a witness or create an absence of evidence that's going to undermine a criminal prosecution in a white-collar case. So he granted their motion, and this, of course, put the government's nose out of joint, and they got a special permission to appeal, and they took it to the D.C. Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is the appeals court for the federal cases from the District of Columbia. Now, you may not know it, but the listeners should know that the majority of the judges now on that appeals court are Obama and Biden appointees. Trump managed to get about three people in there. But all the older conservative Reagan and Bush appointees have all pretty much retired, left, or taken senior status. So it's very much dominated by the left progressives. And you can
This is,
imagine what they did.
yeah, I, my God. This, I mean, this sounds identical to Lavrenti Beria. This is,
Oh, very much.
this is exactly the way he ran the Soviet Union.
Yeah,
This
so
is unbelievable.
this appeals court made a total mess of it. There were three judges on a panel, which is how the appeals courts work. You know, you have one judge in a trial court in the federal system. When you take an appeal, there's supposed to be three randomly selected, and that's another question in some circuits, including the DC circuit, because there's at least one particular left progressive judge who somehow manages to miraculously always be assigned to one of the panels when there's a J6 case. So this case was there three fellows, Lange, Miller, and Fisher. And they all were separate cases, but they were consolidated by the appeals court because the government appealed in all three because the same judge had applied the same ruling to each of them, said not 1512 does not apply to these guys. So the appeals court took a look at it, and the three judges, two Trump appointees and this one Biden appointee, her name is Florence Pan, but they just wrote these three disparate opinions that could not be reconciled. But the bottom line is that they treated it all as, oh, everything's fine, and the government can do whatever it wants with this and apply it to any otherwise unlawful conduct, as long as you're near or somehow can be connected to an official proceeding somewhere. And we don't need to show what you did wrong. We don't need to show the wrong. The mental state of the criminal intent, it's all good. And the one dissenter was Greg Katsas, who's a very brilliant judge. And he said, no. This is clearly when you use all of the regular statutory rules of interpretation, you're supposed to look at this and say this is clearly designed for evidence and witness impairment, and not about crowd control. So the Supreme Court took this case, and they're looking at it specifically for Mr. Fisher. And Mr. Fisher is interesting because what he did, he went to the rally on the Ellipse, and then he went back either home or to his hotel. I forget where he was from. And only when he was heading back to his hotel room did he get word like, oh, people are converging on the Capitol. And he was curious enough to go back into town, and he got there late. So when he got to the east side of the Capitol building, all of the barriers and the fences had already been run down, and everybody was already well inside the building. He walked up in there, joined the crowd, got knocked around, pushed down, and then wound up getting pepper spray in his face. It was all of about 20 minutes in the building, and walked out and went, walked away. Well, they found him on the video, and as I said, they indicted him and they charged him with criminal assault. I guess he attacked the police officer's pepper spray with his face, and
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
and he's charged with this obstruction of justice, 15, 12, 20-year maximum penalty, felony. So it's now being it's been briefed to the United States Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is going to hear oral argument on April 16th. Now, the interesting thing is this 1512 has been charged to at least 200 cases, 200
That
individuals,
yeah,
January
that was
6th
my next
offense.
question. How
And
many? Wow, there are 200 people who have been charged.
over 200. Yeah, depending on whether
Unbelievable.
you go look to the clerk of the court's website or you trust the DOJ press releases. But they're all say anywhere between 200 and 300, 230, 250. They may be missing some of the ones that have already pled guilty and been sentenced. But and they show no sign of relenting in applying that. As I said, I've been advising or monitoring some of the ongoing cases that haven't gone to trial, people who are still charged with this particular statute. And they tell their trial judges, hey, this is pending in the Supreme Court. Can we wait on this or we'll see what happens? It may be thrown out. And a lot of these judges said, not too bad. We're going forward. Deal with it later.
Lovely.
Now, the other interesting thing people should know, if you didn't already, CBD, is that this very same statute is one of the counts brought against Donald Trump in his Washington, D.C. indictment. And not only did they charge 1512C for the obstruction, claiming that he was part of the January 6th problem, they charged him with the organic conspiracy provision within 1512, called 1512K. So not only do they say that he substantively participated in January 6th, he's equally culpable in their eyes for having conspired with all of the January 6th protesters. So it will very much affect his indictment, how the Supreme Court rules on this. And it's been brought to their attention in some of the friends of the court briefs that there are many unintended consequences down the line, because this statute has always been, well, it's been around 20 years, and it's been very well and properly used for people who intimidate witnesses or try to make evidence disappear or something to affect their own criminal case. And it's properly used for judicial administration. And even if you look at the US sentencing guidelines, which are what the judges follow when it's time to sentence someone on this, it's squarely set amidst all the other contempt of court and other judicial administration type crimes. And it's got nothing to do with trespassing or mob control or unruly behavior.
I mean, when I mentioned Beria, I was sort of joking, but this really is following in the footsteps of the Soviet Union.
Oh, absolutely. I like to call it, oh, particularly with regard to main justice, DOJ, it quite literally is as if the East German Stasi have taken over. They're even more vicious than the Russians. The Russians, you know, could be just Russian about things, but the Germans, they're more efficient.
So I want to move on to one of my favorite topics, which is
Okay.
there's a document that was written, I think it was about 100 years ago. It's called the United States Constitution. And
Try
in it,
250.
in it there's a there are a bunch of articles, but on in Article 4, Section 1, which nobody reads anymore. So really, this really isn't a very important thing. But what it says is that the full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the, I'm reading, folks, to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And to me, what that means is, for instance, your driver's license issued in Montana is valid in Mississippi or Florida or Maine. Now, my question is, why is it that my carry permit issued by the state of New Jersey is not valid anywhere else in the United States? Now, obviously, there are constitutional carry states, and they don't really give a shit what New Jersey gave me or not. They consider me a citizen of the United States, therefore they are protecting my rights as a citizen. But there are plenty of states surrounding me, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, where I cannot carry, even though Article 4, Section 1, to me, is quite clear that they should give me the full faith and credit of that state, of the New Jersey state decision to grant me a carry permit.
And you are correct, CBD. In the intent, the meaning, and the design of that provision of the Constitution, driver's license is a good example. Also, marriage licenses. And another fine example where it is honored is, say, you sue somebody in Michigan and you win a judgment, and they've moved or they happen to live in New York, and you want to go enforce that judgment, collect on what they owe you. You may take that Michigan judgment and bring it to a New York court, and as long as you go through whatever authentication and documentary process to show it's a notarized and proper certified copy, it is through the appropriate routine procedures otherwise honored and given full faith and credit. So this is a notable exception, and it's just one more example of how for ages until recently there's been willful ignorance and disregard of the Second Amendment right, in particular on the application of Article 4. I mean, the other part of Article 4 that's interesting and overlaps with that is the guarantee of Republican government or Republican form of government, small r. But that, man, we can go into treatises on that. But the whole idea is that, yes, we brought these states together into this union, and they all have their own right to pass their own laws and run their own state governments. But when we were dealing with each other across state lines, we're supposed to treat each other equally, and each state, as it's admitted to the union, is admitted on an equal footing. And that's an actual legal term, the equal footing doctrine. So that it's not just the first 13 states that get to tell everybody what to do, but every state since then is an equal sovereign and entitled to the same respect and full faith and credit in their official acts.
Has anybody?
So, yeah, this is something that.
Has anybody used this to challenge the?
I don't doubt that. I'm not sure. I haven't looked it up lately. It would be interesting to do that now in light of the resurrection of the Second Amendment by the Supreme Court in the Bruen decision. But as you know, there's a lot of fighting in the trenches now just to get the Bruen case enforced and to put down the massive resistance of the blue states that are willfully disregarding the Constitution. By the way, CBD, this leads me to another idea. I'm going to, you know, I don't know if you mentioned, I had a little bit of a glitch there when I was listening to my introduction. I do publish a Substack on the name Vox Clementis.
Yes, I was going to mention that. In fact, okay. I think your first one addressed the Second Amendment.
Yes, it was. It was. And I encourage people to go look at it. The address is voxclementis1789.substack.com. And that's interesting. It came about because I had in mind, as a constitutional lawyer, I call myself a dissident constitutional lawyer. I had Vox Clementis as the name, and I threw in 1789, thinking that was the first year of the creation of the federal judiciary, the famous Judiciary Act of 1789, as expounded in the Marshall Court. But in in retrospect, I didn't realize that many may consider that to be a reference to the French Revolution, but that's fine. I don't mind if a little blood is spilled in the argumentation. Yes, the first piece I published there was, in fact, on the Second Amendment, and that was prompted by a good friend from college who was preparing to go home and have to argue with a liberal progressive asshole brother-in-law or somebody like that.
We have so many of those, yes.
Oh, yes, they're unavoidable. They're like ticks in the summer. But he needed some ammunition, and I took up the challenge and drafted that for him. So that, because his relative was going to use the usual race card, claim it was all just some racist white supremacist scheme to keep the black man down, which is ridiculous because one of the main points of the 14th Amendment and the incorporation of the Second Amendment was to preserve the right to have firearms for the self-protection of the freed slaves against the Ku Klux Klan and the other militant arms of the
Well, folks, looks like we've had some technical
off. I'm not
difficulties
sure
and
if
we
we're
have. Oh, here he is.
yeah,
Yeah, we
can you hear
lost
me
you for
now?
about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I never lost to hearing you, so I just kept
Oh.
talking to hope that I get through.
Anyway, we're running late anyway, but
Oh,
we had
time
a couple more
flies.
topics. But I apologize to our listeners for getting into the weeds about the J6 persecutions, folks. These are not prosecutions, but I find it fascinating how our legal system has been subverted so completely by a progressive. Boy, I mean, how do I say it? I mean, it's a junta. There's nothing subtle about it. It is a progressive junta in Washington that has destroyed our entire legal structure on the altar of the destruction of conservative thought in America. They are unwilling to accept any conservatism in Washington, and then as we've seen, they're extending it to the states. And it seems like our only hope is the Supreme Court. And I didn't have any idea about this US v. Fisher case, and I'm going to start following that, and I hope everyone else does too. Anyway, Vox, you have any last comments?
Well, I'll offer a hopeful suggestion. When next we are actually able to pass federal legislation, we should pass a statute that allows anybody who's charged with a crime or any type of lawsuit in the District of Columbia federal courts should be, and they're not a resident of the District of Columbia, should be allowed at their option to remove that case to their home district. It is ridiculous to penalize people who are exercising their First Amendment right to travel and petition the government for redress of grievances and be penalized by the local community in DC for their conservative views, as you've said. So they should be able to go back home to have a jury of their own true peers to judge whether or not they were misbehaving when they went to the seat of the government.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Okay, folks, so we're gonna close this out. My guest has been Vox Clematis, and I'm trying to find his exact Substack address, and I can't, so I will post it.
VoxClematis1789.substack.com.
There it is, folks. I will post it on Cut Jib Newsletter. Anyway, thank you for listening. This has been Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast. And once again, folks, thanks for listening.